This is Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust. Hello, hello. Welcome back to Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust. I'm Chris Fitch. Today we're talking outcomes, not processes, not outputs, not box ticking, but the real world changes that customers actually feel make a difference. Now, across our sectors, the bar has already been set. We all know that consumers in vulnerable circumstances should experience outcomes as good as anyone else's. But that's easy to say and clearly quite hard to do. However, a new model has emerged, one that promises to help us define what we want our outcomes to achieve, to identify what actions are needed to do this, and to then establish whether our actions have worked and what to do in response to improve things further or to fix any issues that we've uncovered along the way. Taking us through this new model is David Atkins. David is formerly head of Group Customer Vulnerability and Inclusion at Lloyds Banking Group, and is now lead outcomes consultant for the Money Advice Trust. But more importantly, David is the creator of the PAIR approach to achieving real outcomes and impact for customers in vulnerable circumstances. So I asked Dave to explain more about the approach and also about the opportunity to get hands-on experience with it in a special event that he's running in January. David, fantastic to have you on the podcast that Vulnerability Matters. Let's get straight into it. What's an outcome and what isn't an outcome?
Really good question to start with, and actually a really key question. If you can't answer that, the rest of it, to be honest, falls to pieces. So an outcome, in my mind, is the result, consequence or effect of on customers of our action or inaction. And I very purposely talk about inaction because sometimes we'll make a decision not to do something, but sometimes we don't even know that we should be taking action because we don't have the data. And therefore, it's very clear that it can be our action or inaction. So that's kind of the high level definition of an outcome in my mind. But we shouldn't forget that a good outcome can also be nothing happened, like we prevented a poor or a bad thing from happening, or that an outcome was half achieved or half prevented. So there was a change, but it wasn't quite the full one we expected. Or it could be that something bad started to happen. We spotted it and then we prevented it. What isn't an outcome is an output. So to my mind, an output is something functional that we provide a customer. So it could be we offer real-time balance alerts so that customers can monitor their spending. That in itself is not an outcome. That's a function of something that we do. What we're trying to get to, for example, with a balance alert, is to enable a customer to manage their own finances safely. That's the outcome we're trying to achieve. Because if you think about it, from a customer's point of view, they don't buy a product from a bank, for example, because I want a shiny bank account on my shelf. It looks nice. They want it so they can participate in the wider market. And therefore, the outcome that we're looking to achieve is to enable them to participate in that wider market. And we know that vulnerable customers have more barriers in being able to do that. And so what we're looking for here is an emotional outcome, i.e. I can participate in this market, or it aligns to the identity that I have. So, for example, if I am deaf, I am part of a community and I want my community to be able to participate. And so when you're looking at your outcomes, you're not just looking at the function of I'm delivering something to a customer. You're actually looking at, is it achieving what you're trying to achieve?
So you touched on it then, and the regulatory exam question, which you just mentioned, and it's pretty much the same across all sectors. Financial services, energy, water, telcos. The things we're all aiming for is that we want vulnerable consumers to have outcomes as good as those for other consumers who are not vulnerable to harm. And that mission's really clear, but, and it's a big but, firms often really struggle to define, develop and measure the consumer outcomes needed. What, in your experience, why is this? Why does this happen?
So I think there's a number of reasons, and it's interesting when you actually look at some of the feedback from the FCA based on the market work that they've done. So in 2024, for example, they did a multi-firm review with insurance firms looking at outcomes monitoring under the Consumer Duty. But also they did a piece of work with retail banks, and they looked at the treatment of customers in vulnerable circumstances. And if you look at the outcomes of those two things, there was a number of kind of common themes that came out of that. The first was that good firms clearly used clear customer outcomes, relevant metrics, and proactive identification of issues to enable the right outcome for their customers. But that implied clearly that there are a number of firms that need to improve because they struggled to define a clear customer outcome, which is really the first hurdle. So I think the high-level answer to your question is, if you don't define your outcome well, the rest of it falls down because you don't actually know, well, if I don't know what my outcome is, how do I measure it? What actions do I need to take to make it happen? And what do I do if it's not happening? Because you haven't defined it in the first place. Also, the FCA found that many firms rely on incomplete data for monitoring, so they don't understand their outcome and how it's being achieved. They saw quite commonly senior committees lacked insight, so they didn't get to see what was going on. And of course, if the senior people who, let's frankly, own the purse strings and the resources, if they can't see where things are not working, they can't allocate the resources to make them work. And the final thing that I'd mention is about SLAs and their service level agreements they saw didn't directly reflect customer experiences, which I think is in part linked to that previous question. If you understand and measure the emotional or identity level outcome for a customer, you can actually align your SLAs to measure that and not just the functional outcome.
Okay, that's really interesting. So a sense of how it's impacting on the consumer as well as us doing our homework and delivering it is really, really key. And I also picked up on the fact that, look, if we're going to build our outcome measurement frameworks on foundations of sand, we haven't got the basics in place. Don't expect to have rigor or robustness as you proceed
absolutely
forwards. And I know this is an area you've been working with, which is about getting those foundations in place. And I think regardless of regulatory sector, whether it's banking or energy, it's the same solid foundation we're looking for. And you've created a framework to help us walk through this and think through this called PAIR, not the one you eat. PAIR. Can you give us an overview? You can tell it's near to lunch. Could you give us an overview of what PAIR stands for, how this works, and where it's come from?
Cool. So actually, where it come from, I think I'll start with. It has come from looking at what good firms do, looking at the FCA feedback on the market when they looked at it both through insurance firms and retail banks last year, but also and clearly looking at the FCA guidance on vulnerability as well as Consumer Duty. And when you talk to many firms, they may not have this framework in the same way, but their thought process is quite similar. And PAIR basically stands for purpose, action, information, and reaction. And what you're basically looking at is purpose is all about defining your desired outcome. So as I mentioned before, if you fail at the first hurdle by not defining your outcome, the rest of it falls by the wayside. And so first is purpose, define your outcome. Second then is action, which is, so what actions do you need to take to achieve your outcome? So if you've defined that outcome, you know what you need to do to get there. But also by knowing those actions, that gives you some of the information that you're going to need in the next bit, which is information, because clearly you can track how you deliver those actions. And so the third bit, information, is about developing and using insights. That's about creating the information that tells you both the inputs, i.e. the actions, have they been achieved, but also the outputs. So is the outcome that we're looking for actually being achieved? Accepting sometimes you need to have some proxy measures of those outcomes. You can't always measure it precisely, but you can sometimes monitor the effect of the outcome. And the final bit, reaction, is about taking action. So it's all well and good understanding your outcome, having actions delivering it, and then having the information to assess it. But if the information is telling you you're not achieving the outcome, you need to react. You need to understand what you need to do to get back on track to deliver your outcome. So that's basically what PAIR is. It's about knowing your outcome, taking action, knowing whether that action is achieving what you set out to do, and thirdly, reacting if it's not.
That's fantastic. And having that simplicity of framework allows us all then to speak a common language, because that's where we can get a sense of kind of where we are, either for a particular outcome measure or a whole set of outcome measures, or thinking about some of the comparisons that we might make over time. So let's walk through the PAIR model in a bit more detail, just so we can understand each of those elements. And let's start with the P for purpose in PAIR.
Yeah.
How should firms go about tackling this stage? What should they be doing and thinking about?
Cool. So there's a few things I think to consider. When you're looking to define your outcome, the first thing to do is to define at what level you want to define your outcome. And I look at this with three levels. The first is an overall outcome. So it's basically what's the standard treatment you're trying to achieve for all customers, regardless of whether they're vulnerable or not. The next level is what I'd call the vulnerability cohort level. So this is making sure that you've got support available for specific groups or people with specific needs. And then the third level is the individual level. So this is making sure that the interventions that you have or the treatments that you have actually improve those customers' situations. So if you're applying a treatment to support a customer's need, you need to make sure it's working. And so you'll find most firms will need a mixture of all three, but you'd almost want your headline overall outcome definition. You'd want then a series of tailored vulnerability cohort level outcomes you're trying to achieve, because they act as the proxy for your wider population. And then, of course, you need to make sure that the actions you are taking are working, and therefore that's your individual level. It's also worth bearing in mind, as I mentioned earlier on, you're also trying to, at the same time, define what you perhaps don't want to happen or you want to stop happening. And so I would look at outcomes, approaching it from two angles. The first thing is to talk about what do I want to achieve? And then secondly, what do I therefore want to prevent happening?
So but the purpose overall, though, is to think about that good outcome and making it happen, being clear in your definition, but also thinking about the harm that could take place if we don't take actions to prevent it, be aware that it might be emerging. So that's the P for purpose in PAIR. So once we've got our purpose clear, we move to A for action. And this is where we get things done. Can you just talk us through what the two or three most critical actions or factors that we might be thinking about here?
Sure. So I think probably the first one is, if you're clear on your outcome, then perhaps inclusive design is the route to deliver that outcome. Because inclusive design is the practice of creating products and services that are accessible, usable and welcoming to the widest possible range of people. And that's like regardless of age, ability, background, circumstance, etc. And therefore, it's about designing your products and services with your customers and your range of customers, not just for them. And in banking, that means designing your products with empathy for those diverse needs of the different customers. So to bring that to life, digital interfaces. So a mobile banking app should probably have adjustable text size, screen reader compatibility, simple navigation support for people with visual impairments. The way that it can present different colors or different approaches depending on people that may have cognitive differences or low digital confidence. Or communication. Most firms already do provide large print or braille or easy read formats for customers. Again, it's making sure if we're talking through these different routes of delivery, different products and services, we consider everybody and what adjustments could we make to make sure everybody can participate with those products. Because inclusive design isn't about one size fits all, because you'll never have a perfect solution that this one thing suits everybody. It's about designing it flexibly so everyone can then participate with that product. And sometimes that's adding on some extra things for certain groups so they can access and use that product. That's probably the first big one, inclusive design. I think
so
the second
inclusive design. So inclusive design is an action to achieve that purpose. Would be
yes.
One of them.
Yes.
So, yeah. I'm sorry, David. What were the others?
Yeah. The other one I think about is staff training initiatives. And so that's all about being clear on who do you need to deliver your purpose, i.e. your outcome? What do they need to know and what tools will help them do it? And then you develop the training to make that all happen.
That's great. That's three really sort of clear kind of actions we can take to achieve our purpose. There may be other actions that people need to take. There might be operational. There might be changes
Absolutely.
To kind of sort of protocol. But they're three really good examples. Let's move on to kind of I. So we've done the P for purpose, the A for action. The I is now for information. And as I understand, this is about using our information and data to assess if the actions we've taken are working or not. Is that right, David?
It's beyond that. So yes, in part, it can look at whether your actions have been achieved, but also what you're trying to measure here as well is my outcome being achieved? So let me give you a sense of some of the inputs I would look at when I'm talking about information. So the first thing to determine is who is this information for? What's the data for? It could be for a customer level. So this is understanding, do I understand at a customer level whether the outcome for that vulnerable group of customers is as good as it is for others? It could be for colleague. It could be information that you want to have in front of colleagues to help them inform their decisions. And the third one could even be information for the company. So we know, for example, that it takes longer for consumers with characteristics of vulnerability to have phone calls with their bank. In certain cases, it could be twice as long as an average call. And therefore, if you understand those different impacts, you can then start to think, well, if I can solve the problems online or make it easier to solve the problems for certain cohorts of customers automatically, I can reduce the number of people calling me who get that same outcome. And therefore, the information can inform the organization itself on how it can improve its service and its provision to vulnerable customers.
So, yeah, that makes complete sense, because what I'm doing now is following this model is interrogating, interpreting this information and data and thinking about that final part of PAIR, which is the reaction.
Yeah.
What do I do next? So, yeah, how do we do this reaction step?
Cool. And I think the thing I want to draw on first is that word trigger that you used. And I would see some of the differences in data that you see as a trigger to go have a look, not necessarily to have a lot of organizations have a rag status, red, amber, green. And if sometimes people think, oh, there's a big difference, call that red because it's a big difference, which then sends lots of warning signals to lots of people and everybody gets very excited. But actually that difference could be perfectly fine. What you want to do is set some triggers that will then allow you to determine, should I go find out why the difference is there? Am I worried about this or not? But what you're basically looking at on a reaction is going to be a number of different things. The first, probably most common one, is going to be it will lead you to investigate why there's a difference. Because in many cases, the data won't tell you why there's a difference, just that there is. But that should be your trigger to then go and find out why. Because it may be fine. That difference could be perfectly realistic. It could lead you to make some adjustments to your policies or your products. You actually start to learn, well, the reason why this is different, this outcome is different, is because our policy says we should do something. It could be that, well, actually, we will only allow our staff to talk to customers in English because we can do outcome testing of that. But actually, your data may be telling you customers who can't speak English are struggling to make complaints. And therefore, does your policy actually cause a barrier to certain of your customers? It could be that it leads you to create new treatments. And so, for example, in a previous life, when we started to see certain customers who couldn't speak English were struggling to call the fraud team, we were able to develop some solutions to enable translation for those customers so they can participate fully when they need support. And finally, it can if you go back to the beginning, when you talk about when you're doing your outcome and you're trying to prevent bad things happening, you may have planned some actions or reactions if that bad thing starts to happen as part of your action section. And so your reaction is, well, I'll deploy those actions that I thought I might do if the bad thing started to happen. So to give you an example on the investigation bit, which is probably the most common thing you'll do as a result of this, is I was looking a while ago at some data that seemed to imply a certain group of vulnerable customers were more likely to have a non-upheld complaint in the financial element of complaints. And I thought, well, that's odd. Why is that? But when you went in to dig into it, what it basically showed us is that it was complaints about you didn't give me an overdraft when I needed one. And actually, when you then look at that cohort of customers, it was quite right for financial affordability that we declined the overdraft. And therefore, you won't uphold the complaint because it was the right decision. But because it was that cohort of customers that were complaining, it looked like their outcome was unfair compared to everybody else, and it wasn't. And so it gave you comfort, even if the outcome was different, you knew why. But what it did do was lead us to think, well, actually, if we are declining customers in these circumstances, what else could we, should we do? And then was able to develop other solutions of things that you can offer customers once you said, no, we can't give you an overdraft, but here's some other support.
And that plays into that distinction between a functional outcome and the emotional outcome.
Absolutely.
For the consumer.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Purpose, action, information, reaction. We've talked about the PAIR model. In a sentence or two, could a firm implement this tomorrow with the data they already have? Or is this go away and kind of build up your data reservoir, introduce a higher level of maturity around data to really make this work? In short, can we start from scratch or do we need to prepare to use PAIR?
You can start from scratch. Because most firms already track a whole host of different outcomes, whether it be how long does it take for an application for a mortgage to take? How long does a drawdown take? How long between application and approval does it take? Also, many firms are collecting already certain data from customers, like do they need braille? Do they need large print? What other physical adjustments do they need? That already gives you a small group of potentially vulnerable customers that is your cohort. So if you have nothing else, start to compare your overall population with that cohort of customers with characteristics of vulnerability, you immediately start to be able to do that comparison. And so you can start to go down that road and then you can start to iterate and start to think, well, actually, how can I better define my outcomes? And then you start going through PAIR. So I understand my outcomes. I therefore can take action. What information do I need to track it? And as a result, what reaction should I take?
Perfect. Right. Two very quick rapid fire questions. If you could leave the audience with one single message about the PAIR model and consumer outcomes, what would it be? And where can we go to learn more about consumer outcomes and vulnerability?
I suppose the single message is to achieve a fair outcome for all customers, we've got to define what good looks like, use data to understand who's at risk of harm, and take targeted action that makes a measurable difference. And that's because outcomes aren't always what we intend, they're what people actually experience. So that's my one sentence that kind of sums it up. If you want to know more, I think first one obviously is the Vulnerability and Consumer Data Academy that Money Advice Trust offers in conjunction with UK Finance. This stuff, this model is included within that. And with a shameless plug, at the end of January, we're going to be doing a very specific customer outcomes course with the Money Advice Trust, where we're going to focus on this model, but try and bring it to life with some good case studies, facilitated sessions and interactive debates. And it's really about giving participants a clear step-by-step kind of walk through this outcomes process.
Fantastic. David Atkins, thank you very much.
And we've reached the ultimate outcome. the end of today's episode. As was mentioned, on January 28th and 29th, David is running an online event on the PEAR model. You can find out more about this and get your tickets at moneyadvicetrust.org/vulnerability. Go to our public courses section. It's a paid event, but you'll be getting a whole host of new skills and approaches on outcomes, and you'll be helping to keep the lights on at National Debtline, as the Money Advice Trust are, after all, a charity. So everybody wins, and how often can you say that? And that's it for this episode. So until next time, pair up, keep outcoming the opposition, and keep on remembering that vulnerability matters. Vulnerability Matters was produced by Mandy McGreevy and Phil King, and brought to you by the Money Advice Trust.